This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. That's LibriVox.org. Recording by Christy Nowak. The History of England from the Accession of James II by Thomas Babington Macaulay. Book 1, Chapter 5. Part 9. It was not only by the inaction of the Whig aristocracy that the invaders were disappointed. The wealth and power of London had sufficed in the preceding generation, and might again suffice to turn the scale in a civil conflict. The Londoners had formerly given many proofs of their hatred of popery and of their affection for the Protestant Duke. He had too readily believed that, as soon as he landed, there would be a rising in the capital. But, though advices came down to him that many thousands of citizens had been enrolled as volunteers for the good cause, nothing was done. The plain truth was that the agitators who had urged him to invade England, who had promised to rise on the first signal, and who had perhaps imagined, while the danger was remote, that they should have the courage to keep their promise, lost heart when the critical time drew near. Wildman's fright was such that he seemed to have lost his understanding. The craven Danvers at first excused his inaction by saying that he would not take up arms till Monmouth was proclaimed king, and, when Monmouth had been proclaimed king, turned round and declared that good Republicans were absolved from all engagements to a leader who had so shamefully broken faith. In every age, the vilest specimens of human nature are to be found among demagogues. On the day following that on which Monmouth had assumed the regal title, he marched from Taunton to Bridgewater. His own spirits, it was remarked, were not high. The acclamations of the devoted thousands who surrounded him wherever he turned could not dispel the gloom which sate on his brow. Those who had seen him during his progress through Somersetshire 5 years before could not now observe without pity the traces of distress and anxiety on those soft and pleasing features which had won so many hearts. Ferguson was in a very different temper. With this man's knavery was strangely mingled an eccentric vanity which resembled madness. The thought that he had raised a rebellion and bestowed a crown had turned his head. He swaggered about, brandishing his naked sword and crying to the crowd of spectators who had assembled to see the army march out of Taunton, quote, "Look at me! You have heard of me. I am Ferguson, the famous Ferguson, the Ferguson for whose head so many £100 have been offered." End quote. And this man, at once unprincipled and brainsick, had in his keeping the understanding and the conscience of the unhappy Monmouth. Bridgewater was one of the few towns which still had some Whig magistrates. The mayor and aldermen came in their robes to welcome the Duke, walked before him in procession to the High Cross, and there proclaimed him king. His troops found excellent quarters, and were furnished with necessaries at little or no cost by the people of the town and neighborhood. He took up his residence in the castle, a building which had been honored by several royal visits. In the castle field, his army was encamped. It now consisted of about 6,000 men, and might easily have been increased to double the number, but for the want of arms. The Duke had brought with him from the continent but a scanty supply of pikes and muskets. Many of his followers had, therefore, no other weapons than such as could be fashioned out of the tools which they had used in husbandry or mining. Of these rude implements of war, the most formidable was made by fastening the blade of a scythe erect on a strong pole. The tithing men of the country round Taunton and Bridgewater received orders to search everywhere for scythes and to bring all that could be found to the camp. It was impossible, however, even with the help of these contrivances, to supply the demand, and great numbers, who were desirous to enlist, were sent away. The foot were divided into 6 regiments. Many of the men had been in the militia and still wore their uniforms, red and yellow. The cavalry were about 1,000 in number, but most of them had only large colts, such as were then bred in great herds on the marshes of Somersetshire for the purpose of supplying London with coach horses and cart horses. These animals were so far from being fit for any military purpose that they had not yet learned to obey the bridle and became ungovernable as soon as they heard a gun fired or a drum beaten. A small bodyguard of 40 young men, well armed and mounted at their own charge, attended Monmouth. The people of Bridgewater, who were enriched by a thriving coast trade, furnished him with a small sum of money. All this time, the forces of the government were fast assembling. On the west of the rebel army, Albemarle still kept together a large body of Devonshire militia. On the east, the trained bands of Wiltshire had mustered under the command of Thomas Herbert, Earl of Pembroke. On the northeast, Henry Somerset, Duke of Beaufort, was in arms. The power of Beaufort bore some faint resemblance to that of the great barons of the 15th century. He was President of Wales and Lord Lieutenant of 4 English counties. His official tours through the extensive region in which he represented the majesty of the throne were scarcely inferior in pomp to royal progresses. His household at Badminton was regulated after the fashion of an earlier generation. The land, to a great extent around his pleasure grounds, was in his own hands, and the laborers who cultivated it formed part of his family. 9 tables were every day spread under his roof for 200 persons. A crowd of gentlemen and pages were under the orders of the steward. A whole troop of cavalry obeyed the master of the horse. The fame of the kitchen, the cellar, the kennel, and the stables was spread over all England. The gentry many miles round were proud of the magnificence of their great neighbor, and were at the same time charmed by his affability and good nature. He was a zealous cavalier of the old school. At this crisis, therefore, he used his whole influence and authority in support of the crown, and occupied Bristol with the train bands of Gloucestershire, who seemed to have been better disciplined than most other troops of that description. In the counties more remote from Somersetshire, the supporters of the throne were on the alert. The militia of Sussex began to march westward under the command of Richard, Lord Lumley, who, though he had lately been converted from the Roman Catholic religion, was still firm in his allegiance to a Roman Catholic king. James Bertie, Earl of Abingdon, called out the array of Oxfordshire. John Fell, Bishop of Oxford, who was also Dean of Christ Church, summoned the undergraduates of his university to take arms for the crown. The gownsmen crowded to give in their names. Christ Church alone furnished near 100 pikemen and musketeers. Young noblemen and gentlemen commoners acted as officers, and the eldest son of the Lord Lieutenant was colonel. But it was chiefly on the regular troops that the king relied. Churchill had been sent westward with the blues, and Feversham was following with all the forces that could be spared from the neighborhood of London. A courier had started for Holland with a letter directing Skelton instantly to request that the 3 English regiments in the Dutch service might be sent to the Thames. When the request was made, the party hostile to the House of Orange, headed by the deputies of Amsterdam, again tried to cause delay. But the energy of William, who had almost as much at stake as James, and who saw Monmouth's progress with serious uneasiness, bore down opposition, and in a few days the troops sailed. The 3 Scotch regiments were already in England. They had arrived at Gravesend in excellent condition, and James had reviewed them on Blackheath. He repeatedly declared to the Dutch ambassador that he had never in his life seen finer or better disciplined soldiers, and expressed the warmest gratitude to the Prince of Orange and the States for so valuable and seasonable a reinforcement. This satisfaction, however, was not unmixed. Excellently as the men went through their drill, they were not untainted with Dutch politics and Dutch divinity. One of them was shot, and another flogged, for drinking the Duke of Monmouth's health. It was therefore not thought advisable to place them in the post of danger. They were kept in the neighborhood of London till the end of the campaign, but their arrival enabled the king to send to the west some infantry which would otherwise have been wanted in the capital. End of part 9.